Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.
Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
Hi, this is Jad.
Hi.
Hey, it's me, Jad.
And I'm Robert.
And this first story started when we bumped into an article in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Were you a little bit weirded out as to why we are calling you?
Yes. I just don't understand the whole thing. The
story really gets going with a phone call to this woman, Elizabeth Mason.
I'm a receptionist / switchboard operator.
She works at a research lab in Boston, and one day she's sitting in her desk, and she gets a call from a woman who says that she has donated some eyes to them, and she wants to know what happened to them.
This is not a call you get every day.
I just remember... It was just very unusual, right? And I didn't know what to do with it. I just felt like I got to find somebody to help this woman.
Today, we're going to tell you the story of the woman on the other end of that phone call. This is her story. You might say their story.
So for my title, should I say, I'm Sarah Gray. I'm the mom.
I'm Ross Gray. I'm Thomas's dad.
And how did you guys meet?
We met in a bar in Glasgow.
Really?
Yeah, I was on vacation with a girlfriend.
What happened? Without getting into too many.
I don't know. I think we've got different ideas and different recollection of what happened. But
we started dating across the ocean for a year and a half, and then he moved to America.
5 days after he arrived, they were married. A few years after that, they were pregnant with twins.
Mm-hmm.
And when did you first know that something was up?
It was at the 12-week screening. They call it the first trimester screening, and they're checking for birth defects. I think the most common one is Down syndrome. But it was September 30th, 2009.
They went in for the screening. The ultrasound tech took a scan of the two fetuses. And shortly after, the doc came into the room.
And said that only one of the twins would make it, and one of the twins had anencephaly and would die within a few minutes or hours of being born. And he said he could see that because one of the twins had a round skull and the other one had a bumpy skull.
Huh.
But the bumpy skull showed him that the skull wasn't correct, wasn't round enough.
The brain and skull weren't forming properly, which is what anencephaly is.
Bit of a shock, obviously.
Yeah. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, you're just kind of... It's difficult to process it, I think, because you think, no, that can't be right. They've just told us it's identical twins, but one of them's completely different from the other.
It sounded fictional to me.
Yeah.
Making matters worse.
The doctors said that the unhealthy twin was posing a threat to the healthy twin, and if we were to be safe... We would do a selective termination to save the life of the healthy twin.
Hmm. So Sarah says they were suddenly faced with this choice.
I actually talked to two priests on the phone about it.
Really?
Yeah.
Her family's Catholic. She was raised Catholic.
I don't know. I guess I wanted to see what their take was on this.
Yeah.
This is probably not the direction we want to go to for this radio story, but...
No, I mean, I'm suddenly interested.
Basically, what I was saying is, would you come and do a blessing over this selective termination?
And what'd they say?
One priest said... No, he just said he wouldn't do a blessing over a selective termination. And then the other priest said that because of a Thomas Aquinas rule of, like, I think it was called double account or something, basically, like the rule that if a train is coming and you, like, you want to save the life of someone on the train tracks and you shoot the driver, that's the right thing to do.
After looking it up, it's actually called the Doctrine of Double Effect, and she's basically right, maybe not the part about shooting the driver, but the overall idea is that if you're trying to do good, and on the way to doing good, you must inadvertently do some harm, it's okay in certain circumstances as long as your intentions are good.
Anyway, the priest said because you're doing this with the intent of saving the healthy twin, that he would be there and he would do a blessing.
Fast forward a few weeks.
We'd booked a hotel and we'd packed our bags. And the night before was really terrible for both of us because, I don't know, we had seen him on the screen and we sort of were attached to this little kid.
Next day, they go in for the procedure.
We go into the room, and the doctor puts the sonogram on me and start getting ready. And he said, your placenta has moved since the last time you were here. And the location where it is right now, I don't think we should do this. He said, if I nick it, if I even just nick it a little bit, like, you're going to bleed uncontrollably, and this is not safe to do.
He said that he wouldn't do it on his wife. Either.
What was that like to be on the table? You've gone
relief.
Was it relief? Really?
It was a relief. Yeah,
oh my god! We like got in the elevator. We just hugged. And we're like, oh.
I think the decision's taken out of your hands. You know, so it's
not our fault.
But then your healthy twin is more at risk, maybe.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was like a nail biter for the rest of the 6 months.
And according to Ross, those 6 months were deeply strange.
Just buying one of everything when you know there's two babies coming, and we knew we were going to be having a funeral as well. So, you know, I called the, the funeral director and told him, you know, we're going to be having a funeral. And like, well, when was the death? I'm like, well, I don't know. The guy's not even born yet, you know, but I know.
That's very weird. Know.
All right. So they get to the day of March
23rd.
Okay. 2010.
10:30 a.m.
Thomas came out first. Thomas. And he's the sick one that had anencephaly. Yeah. And then a minute later, Callum came out. And I wasn't sure if Thomas was going to be born alive. I sort of expected him to die within a few minutes, but...
He was struggling at first when he came out. They didn't think he was going to last too long, but then he kind of...
He rallied,
and he was doing pretty good. And then...
Oddly, it was then Callum, the healthy twin, who started to have some trouble at the beginning. And so he and Sarah went off to the infant ICU. And so Ross says, in the delivery room...
It was just me and Thomas for quite a while, actually. We were just sitting together.
What was that like, Ross?
It was, you know, he was cute, you know, it was like a brand new baby, you know, they cry, but he was like grabbing onto my finger and, I don't know, doing the kind of things that babies do, you know, there's nothing you can do but just kind of give him a cuddle, you know, and try and stop him crying and cheer him up.
I remember coming to the recovery room and Ross had this little bundle in his arms and I said, who's that? And he said, Thomas. And I said, he's alive? And I'm like, oh, let me hold him. And so I held him, and yeah, he was cute. Like, he breastfed, and we could feed him with the bottle.
They ended up taking him home?
I didn't really plan on that. Like, we didn't have another car seat. We just didn't think of that. And I remember thinking, like, what if he's going to beat the odds? Like, do we need to arrange daycare? And, like, you know, we hadn't thought of that.
He seems all right. You know, he could hang in here for a while, you know.
But then soon after, Thomas started having seizures, started having trouble breathing. Stopped eating.
And at the time, I remember thinking, you know, like, come on, little guy, like, just eat some more. Like, if you eat some more, then you'll be stronger. I was like, just eat.
Well, so how long did Thomas live in the end?
Six days.
He died in Ross's arms, and he was surrounded by all of the people that loved him. And then right then, we called the Washington Regional Transplant Community. They sent a van over to our house and they picked up his body and took him to DC Children's National Medical Center.
Okay, so this is where the story really gets going, I guess. So how did that idea of donating his organs come into your head?
Did you see an article in the paper, a newspaper article or something?
Yeah, my mom saw an article about a baby who had anencephaly who donated liver cells. And most major religions support organ donation.
Oh, okay. So the van came, picked up Thomas. What happened next?
Nothing happened.
Nothing
after
happened.
After that, for a long time, you know,
We got some letters.
We got a letter in the mail, I guess.
It was sort of a form letter. It basically said, thank you for your generous donation. Thomas's corneas have been sent to this place in Boston where they study potential cure for blindness. And his livers have been sent to this place in Durham, North Carolina, where they study ways to treat liver disease.
It seemed generic to me because I thought, I want to know, like, Like, who ordered it? Which researcher got it? And what study are they working on?
But, you know, they went on with their lives because they had this new baby Callum to raise, so they put it behind them for the most part. But then Sarah says they got to the one-year anniversary.
The one-year anniversary felt like a big moment to me. Like, that's when I can... That's when it stops being in the present and it can start being in the past. You know, just explaining it to people, at least I can say it was a year ago so they don't have to feel stressed out when they talk to me. And it felt like a big deal. Like, I think we were going to go to the cemetery and put some flowers on his grave. And I wanted to tell my family what were the results of his donation.
So she called the donor family services person at the place that picked up Thomas's body, and she basically asked them,
like, is there any more information you can give us about the specific study or the researcher, if something was published? And they didn't have any. So I just thought, okay, well, I tried, you know.
But she couldn't quite let it go.
I mean, what do you mean she couldn't quite let it go?
You know, it was curiosity, but I also think she was having... on some level, like a big conversation with the universe. I think they both were. Like, this terrible thing happened. How do you explain it to yourself?
I don't know.
I mean, I think, honestly, it sort of shook my faith in God and how the universe works. I thought that karma worked, or if I was basically a good person and I obeyed the rules, good things would happen to me.
Whatever the reason, these thoughts about Thomas and where he ended up, they were just there. She had no real opportunity to act on it, so they would just kind of come in and out of her mind. But then around the two-year anniversary, so this is now a year later.
I had a business trip to Boston, and I was exhibiting at a conference at Heinz Convention Center. And I Googled it, and I saw that Skype and Zai Research Institute was just a few miles away.
That's where Thomas's corneas had been sent. Lunch break.
That's exactly what I did. I called Skypens, and I said, you know, I donated my son's eyes to this lab a couple years ago, and I'm here in town. Is there any chance I can come by for a tour for like 10 minutes?
That must have been a weird phone call.
Yes. I mean, yes.
Yeah, that was like a waker upper.
That's Elizabeth Mason again.
It was just very unusual.
I think she was surprised.
I didn't know what to do with it.
Had you ever gotten a call like that before?
Never have gotten a call.
And she's been working there for 25 years.
She said, hold on, let me connect you to the right person. Don't hang up.
A lot of times when I say something, they hang up on me. So I said, please hold the line while I started searching for someone to speak with her.
It's going
to
take me a while because I got to figure out who that is, but don't hang up. And they connected me with someone in donor relations, but it was financial donor relations.
Oh, like the development department.
Yeah.
Not an organ donor.
But because they don't have any other donor relations. That, you know, like that was the person that gives the tours and deals with the public. So that she got to talk to me and she was.
Sarah says the woman was a little bit flustered, but super nice, and said, we know we've never done this before, but yeah, come on down. We'll give you a tour.
I was so excited. I took pictures of the outside of the building, and I stood in the lobby, and I put one of the brochures in my purse, and I just felt like, I can't believe I'm here. This is like being in Santa's workshop or something. Like, I didn't think this was a place you could actually visit.
She was taken around, and eventually she got taken to the lab where Thomas's corneas went.
And there were refrigerators with signs that said, no food. And then she introduced me to this guy called Dr. James Ziske, who's a professor of ophthalmology at Harvard Med School. And he was eating his lunch at his desk, and she explained who I was. And he said, you know, thank you for the donation, and do you have any questions for me?
And of course she did.
I wanted to know how valuable the eyes were, like if they get thousands and thousands, or if they get one or two, or like when the delivery came, was everyone excited, or was it no big deal? Like, was it sitting on a shelf collecting dust, or were people doing stuff with it?
He put down his lunch.
And he said, most of the eyes that we get are from people who are older, just because most people are older when they die. And infants' eyes are worth their weight in gold.
Wow.
I was like, could barely speak. I was like, could you tell me why? He said, because they regenerate, they have regenerative properties. And he said, if you don't mind me asking, how long ago did your son die? And I said, about 2 years ago. And he said, well, we're likely still using your son's cells right now. Because that's how long they last.
Wow.
I know.
So at that point, Sarah was like, okay. Since that worked out so well, why not just keep going with it and visit all of the places where bits and pieces of Thomas ended up. So, you know, to chase down his liver, his retina, his cord blood.
Well, how many doctors might that be? Do you have any idea?
Well, there's the Boston one. There's two in North Carolina. She would ultimately discover one in Richmond, Virginia, one in Philly.
But wait a second. What if it turns out that these people, didn't find anything? You know, research is research. You don't always have a hit.
That's true.
She's not heading for validation necessarily here. She might get further lost.
Well, yeah.
But she's going to go?
Well, she already went. And after that, her and Ross get in a car and head down south.
To Durham, North Carolina.
To track down Thomas's liver and a bit of his blood.
Cord blood.
Because it turns out that in the delivery room, right after both twins were born, nurses had withdrawn a little bit of cord blood from both twins, sent it off to Duke, where researchers were studying the disease that killed Thomas, anencephaly.
Mm-hmm.
She says they walked in.
We met the study coordinator, this guy who worked on the Human Genome Project, a grad student.
They met all these different researchers who all seemed really excited about her twins' blood samples.
I think it was just weird that one of them had anencephaly and one of them didn't, and they were genetically identical.
Yeah, so it's a good control study for them to compare.
After they all took the tour, one of the researchers even told them that they had compared Thomas's blood to Callum's.
And they found there were 1,000 differences in epigenetics between both twins.
Huh.
They're called epigenetic differences. I think their genes are the same, but the things that control the genes were different.
That's so interesting. So they began identical, but then somehow in utero, 1,000 little changes crept up between them.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's possible that a few of those changes might one day explain the disease.
In fact, I even asked the grad student who worked on it most closely, Deirdre Krupp. I said, were you surprised by what you saw? And she said, for me to be surprised, that implies that I knew what to expect. She said, we're just at the beginning of this trying to learn about this.
So that's two roses. Like, this is amazing.
Yeah, visit two sort of kicked butt.
She's on a roll here.
So after visit two, they got in the car, drove down the street to this place called Cytonet, which is where Thomas's liver ended up.
Basically, Cytonet will take a solid liver and they liquefy it. And then they inject the liquid liver into a baby that's waiting on a liver transplant as a bridge therapy.
Liquid liver.
Liver in a tube.
Yeah.
They went in, again, got a tour.
Refrigerators, petri dishes.
The whole thing. The researchers then tell her that they had a little issue with Thomas's liver.
His liver was bruised when they got it, so they couldn't inject it into a baby.
Hmm.
But then they told her that they were able to use it in an experiment.
To determine what was the best temperature to freeze infant liver cells, which is negative 150 degrees Celsius. As you already know.
Common knowledge.
Okay, half a rose there.
Half a rose.
Yeah.
And she says at one point, as they were being walked around the place.
We walked through the break room, and someone had taken a picture of Thomas that we had handed out. And they took the photograph, and they taped it up in the break room with a little sign that they wrote on it saying, Thomas Gray was a donor here March 29th, 2010. And I was so excited to see that because I thought they're just as curious about us as we are about them. Like, I always wonder what kind of person goes to work and opens up a box with the liver in it? And they're probably wondering what kind of person takes their loved one's liver and puts it in a box and mails it over here.
So my name is Arupa Ganguly. I'm a professor in the Department of Genetics at University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine.
Now, Arupa Ganguly, just to switch to her for a second, she studies a kind of cancer of the eye called retinal blastoma, which happens almost exclusively in children. And at this point, she doesn't know Sarah. She has no concept of this whole search that's happening. She is just studying eyes.
Where are we, by the way?
Philly.
Philly, Philadelphia.
Now, she studies tumors, but she also needs healthy retinas in order to do her work.
Now, you can imagine that getting a normal retina is not a very easy task, because why would you get a normal retina from a baby? I must tell you that if and when an eyeball comes, it is not a pleasant experience, right? Because for a moment, you have to think the origin, the sources of this eyeball. And it's sad. In every possible setting, it's sad.
Sad and frustrating, she says.
Because only when a normal child dies, that's when I can get this retina. So it's a horrible setup in my mind.
So she says often when the retinas arrive, which happens maybe once a year, and you pull them out of their packaging.
You right away, you feel like...
like maybe you're trading on other people's misery.
And I mean, it's so bad when a child dies but I am asking for his or her retina.
Yeah.
In a way, I had this sense of guilt in my head.
Now, Rupa had never spoken to a parent of any of her samples. So when she got that email, and she was sitting at her computer and she read the email from the company that provided her the sample saying the mother of this sample wants to get in contact with you.
I paused. I stopped and doing what I was doing. And I thought, why does the mother want to talk to me? That was my first question. So I did not reply right away. But after my conversation with the lab, I took, I think, one day to compose a letter, and I sent it back to Sarah Gray.
And they ended up eventually talking on the phone.
I told her, I think, at the very onset that, Sarah, you have to understand that I feel awful.
She said she felt kind of guilty because she wished for the sample.
Like almost by wishing for it, she had made it happen.
She said, Arupa, you should not feel bad about it.
If you didn't use my son's retina, I would have buried it in the ground. Like, you're the only one that wanted it.
Bad things happen to children. And so by being able to help you with your work...
We added a layer to Thomas's life.
That was... I was amazed.
Eventually, Sarah and Ross visited Arupa's lab. She gave them a tour. And she showed them Thomas's retina.
She still has samples of it in her freezer. Tiny little, I don't know.
Tiny little vials, maybe a third the size of your pinky, filled with frozen liquid.
Liquefied retina.
RNA. It didn't look like much, but it was amazing to think of how many people were involved getting these samples there. Like, we had to approve it. We had to fill out this paperwork. Then the doctor had to come and remove the eyes. Then the eyes had to be processed. And the eyes have to be shipped up there. And then they have to do whatever DNA process they do, and just how, I don't know, valuable, maybe even priceless, the sample is.
Sarah says that throughout the whole process, you know, of losing a child and then seeing him reclaimed bit by bit by all of these different people,
something shifted in me. I used to think, like, the universe treated people the way it should. And now I don't really believe that, but I do believe that there are really amazing, kind people in the world. And science and medicine has something to do with that. I started feeling that these were Thomas's colleagues and his coworkers, and that he was a valuable partner in this important research that was being done. And I felt an even more fundamental shift, almost like I had felt like I was a boat on an ocean that was like rocky and choppy with waves. And I had this feeling that I'm not the boat, I'm the ocean. Like, the decisions that I make are changing other people, as opposed to just I'm a boat getting slapped with waves all the time. It has made me feel powerful.
To thank the Philadelphia Inquirer for getting us going on this.
Yeah, especially, yeah, big thanks to Michael Vitez for his reporting, and to Damio Marchetti for production support, and to Latif Nasser for all that help with research.
And if you'd like to hear the story in much more detail, Sarah has a book. It's called A Life Everlasting, and you can buy it at bookstores near you, probably.
Or, you know, you can buy it online. If you go to radiolab.org, we'll link you there. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Stay tuned.
James from San Diego. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Betterment. Let's talk about hustle culture. You know, the whole rise and grind, go big or go home thing. It's a lifestyle that may not be for you, but one that your money can handle thanks to Betterment. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. How? Their automated technology optimizes your investments again and again. With Betterment, your money is taking ice baths at 5 a.m. while you get your well-deserved rest. Your money downs protein smoothies and automatically reinvests your dividends, all before you head out the door. Your money is a workaholic, but you don't have to be because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
And so far in this particular program, we've been talking about medicine and research and heart and serendipity. Sometimes when something sad happens, like a baby dies, there are startlingly beautiful things that follow. But it takes a remarkable mom and scientists who are themselves remarkable to sort of make all that happen. So that was a really nice story.
Yeah. We're going to take a little bit of a turn now.
Yeah.
This is also a story about, you know, the places that medical research can take us. But this medical research is going to take us to a place that you might say is wildly exciting or a little bit scary. It actually begins with a healthy dose of both for me because I was terrified and a little bit titillated.
You were some kind of an affair?
Yeah, so I'll tell you how I was at a party.
Party.
It was a conference where they had a lot of different people of different disciplines come together. You know, one of those. There are panel discussions of various things. And so we were at one of the, like, functions, and it was a situation where, like, dinner hadn't yet been served, and there was a lot of booze being served, so everybody was, like, drunk on an empty stomach. Mm-hmm. So I was standing there with some biologists.
Oh, they're the fun ones, the drunk biologists, yes.
As my people, apparently. And they started to lose their like, genuinely lose their about this thing called CRISPR. And, like, I have never seen scientists this excited about anything. So I was like, what is this thing? What is CRISPR? And they were trying to explain it to me, but they couldn't slow down enough for me to get it. I gathered it had something to do with genetics. And then at one point, one of the biologists turned to me and he was like, I'll tell you what it is. I can use CRISPR to take a little dog and poof, make it into a big dog. Give me a Chihuahua, I could turn it into the size of a Great Dane. And I was like, no, you can't. He's like, yes, I can. I could do it with CRISPR. And I was like, what the hell is this thing?
You want me to sit here as usual?
Yeah, if you sit here, I will get up.
I mean to imply in any way.
No.
We'd be sitting here together.
So what happened was I came back and I immediately called science writer Carl Zimmer because I just figured for this kind of thing, this is a Carl thing. I got to talk to Carl. So I basically asked him, like, why all the fuss? Maybe it was just the alcohol, but maybe there's something really happening here.
Oh, there's something totally happening here. I mean, it's big.
He started at the beginning.
So you can actually find, like, the first reference to CRISPR in a 1987 paper from some Japanese scientists. They basically described something weird in E. coli, and they said, we don't know what this is.
E. coli are bacteria inside humans, and like all living things, E. coli is made up of DNA, A's and T's and C's and G's. And what happened was that these scientists were reading a chunk of that genetic code when...
they found this really strange stretch of DNA.
Strange how?
Well, so basically what it was five identical sequences in a row. And then they were separated by very short sequences in between them that were all different from each other.
These little blurps would be like...
and they looked at this and they're like, what? This is nothing like we've seen before.
Repeated sequences in bacterial genomes are kind of unusual.
Seems very strange.
Some biologists felt that, you know, there must be a purpose for these.
Among those purpose seekers?
Jennifer Doudna, University of California, Berkeley.
She's a cell biologist.
Yeah.
So it's Doudna, not Doudna.
It's Doudna. I used to be called the dude sometimes in school. But
in the movie, she will be played by Jeff Bridges.
Right. Anyhow. As time goes on, scientists start seeing these little repeat blurp repeats everywhere.
Yes.
Or at least in bacteria.
Lots and lots and lots of species of bacteria. They say, okay, wait a minute.
That's kind of cool.
They're finding it so often that they decided they had to give it a name.
Is this where the name CRISPR comes from?
Yes. The full official name is...
Clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats.
Oh, my God. Oh.
I don't know why they called it CRISPR. It's kind of a...
CRISPR. It's like a furniture manufacturer or something.
It sounds like an app.
Yeah.
Yeah. CRISPR.
CRISPR.
But now, scientists have this puzzle.
If nature at this level preserves something intact here and here and here and here and here and here, and some of these heres are creatures that have been around for hundreds of millions of years, you figure, well, whatever this is...
it's doing something.
It's doing something.
But what?
It doesn't take very long before the first big clue comes up.
All right, fast forward. 2005, now scientists have these big, searchable databases of DNA sequences. So some scientists think, well, let's do a search. Let's see if these repeating patterns we keep finding match anything else that's out there in the world.
And these scientists are using computers to just line up these stretches of DNA with thousands upon thousands of different species. And then, click, all of a sudden, they discover...
that those bits of DNA between the repeats, the stuff in the middle, those blurps.
These are matching virus DNA. Like you can find viruses with genes where these little, you know, these little...
so the bacteria had virus inside of them?
Yep.
Does that mean that a virus brought it into these cells? Does it tell you anything about the origin of it?
The first recognition was, this is virus DNA. Somehow, all these bacteria have little snippets of virus DNA wedged in these particular places in their genome.
Which is a little weird if you think about it. I mean, these are totally different creatures. It would be like inside a human finding a little bit of mosquito DNA.
Yeah, well, how do we interpret this?
Well, actually, there was one scientist, his name is Eugene Koonin, who looked at these results and just said, okay, I get it. It's a defense system.
What?
Why would he think that?
Because he's a brilliant man.
What do you mean? If I went to a large sanitation dump and I found a teeny bit of human hair, why would I think, oh, I get it, it's a defense mechanism? I wouldn't know. It's just like a bit of human.
Right. Well, you see, that metaphor might sort of betray your lack of skill in microbiology. I'm just saying, like, this is not a dump, all right? This is, bacteria are not going to just let virus DNA get into their genes willy-nilly, okay? Remember, viruses are the big enemy.
Right.
If you're bacteria, viruses make your life a nightmare. Think about in the ocean, okay? The ocean is full of viruses, and viruses kill up to 40% of all of those bacteria every day.
Really?
Every day, yeah. And we know that they have defenses. What Eugene Koonin said was, okay, I'm going to bet that these bacteria are somehow grabbing pieces of DNA from viruses, and then they're storing it, and now they have a way of recognizing those viruses if they come in later.
Oh,
it's like little Polaroid shots of the enemy.
Right.
Know thy enemy.
Yeah, like a most wanted poster.
What you call the mugshot.
This is Eugene Koonin.
Leader of the Evolutionary Genomics Group at the National Center for Biotechnology Information.
He's the guy that Carl referenced who thunk up the whole idea that maybe these bits of virus DNA inside the bacteria is the bacteria trying to defend itself.
But really, if I would credit myself with anything here, it was not so much guessing this, because, you know, when you see these identical sequences, that gets pretty obvious. It is figuring out how the mechanism was likely to work.
So can you walk us through how the mechanism is likely to work?
All right. What happens is,
you know, when a virus comes in to a cell, it just kind of explodes and just kind of releases naked genes, basically.
If you're this bacteria, these things might take over your cells, so you've got to respond.
Most of the time, you have multiple weapons of defense.
If you've never seen this virus before, usually the first thing you do, says Eugene, is you send out these enzymes to attack the viruses. They're sort of like the ground troops, and they fight really hard.
But much of the time, they fail, and then no one will hear about you again.
They're not terribly sophisticated fighters, so very often, the virus takes over, the bacteria dies.
But there is some non-zero probability that you actually survive the attack.
If you do, then what the bacteria will do is send in some new enzymes to basically clean up, to go out, find any stray viruses.
And then cut the enemy DNA into suitable small pieces.
And here, he says, is where you get to the storage part. Those enzymes will then take those little bits of virus and shove them into the bacteria's own DNA, right in those little spaces between the repeats.
Right there and nowhere else.
So I use those spaces in my own DNA as a storage facility?
Yes, if you will. You use it as a memory device.
Because here's what happens. Next time that virus shows up, sprays its genes everywhere, now you are prepared. And this is where the CRISPR story really gets going. Because instead of sending out the ground troops who are probably going to get their asses beat, now you can actually send out the big guns. And in fact, what the cell does is it will manufacture these special molecular assassins. And they'll give those assassins a copy of that little bit of virus DNA it has in storage, basically saying, here, take this mugshot. If you see anything that matches this pattern, kill it.
Ew. And these attackers, do we know what one of them looks like?
Yep, so we know what the protein looks like. It actually looks, I would describe it a little bit like a clamshell.
Sort of imagine Pac-Man, but kind of misshapen and rough. And each one of these guys,
what it has is a copy of that virus DNA.
It's got the mugshot.
That it's kind of waving around. What then happens is that
whenever the Pac-Man bumps into some virus DNA,
it pulls apart the DNA, unzips it,
reads it. If it's not the right one, it goes on. Nope. Mm-mm.
And if that RNA has the same sequence, then click, click, it just locks in.
And if that happens, then the DNA is trapped and molecular blades come out
and chop.
Cutting its head with a mighty blow.
Yeah.
Wow, so this is smart scissors.
So it's like, are you like the thing I got? Are you like the thing I got? You're like the thing I got.
Snip,
snip.
All right, now we're going to kill.
Oh, yeah. I see.
And it has to be exact. It has to be an exact match.
When scientists first discovered this whole system, they were fascinated.
They were like, they were working it out. They were like, oh, okay, then this happens and this happens and this happens. Cool.
But then, in walks
the dude,
Jennifer Doudna, with a crazy idea. Well, I don't know if it's crazy, but radical.
This could be an amazing technology.
This is a tool.
This is a tool.
Yeah.
Right.
This is a tool that we can use to cut DNA where we want to cut DNA.
Her basic thought was, why don't we turn this defense into offense? Because these things, they seem to be really good at cutting, and yet they only seem to cut the things that are on their mugshot, so maybe I could just replace what's on their mugshot. So instead of them going after viruses, maybe they could go after a gene that causes Huntington's disease or hemophilia. For example, and this is actually something that's been done, say you got a mouse with something like hemophilia.
Okay.
This is a disease that's caused by one bad gene. So what you do is you take these little surgeons, you give them the mugshot for the bad gene, then you stick the surgeon with the new mugshot in a mouse.
Then you set it loose.
And just like it's programmed to, it will find that gene.
And click, click. Chop. The scissors will end up cutting exactly the gene you wanted to cut.
So the bad gene's gone. Now the question is, how do you put in the good gene? Right.
Right.
It turns out, actually, according to Jennifer Dowd, now that's actually not as hard as you would think.
Really?
Yeah. Apparently, what you do is just throw this new good gene kind of in the neighborhood of where the old gene used to be. Just in the general vicinity.
You don't have to get super precise. I mean, it turns out that, you know, there are repair enzymes that are probably continually surveying and checking for breaks.
She says what'll happen is that inside the cell, these repair crews, they'll come along, they'll see the break, they'll see the good gene just sitting there next to the break. They'll be like, all right, I'll just stick it in.
Put the pretty guy in this space.
Exactly.
So we take advantage of a natural repair pathway that cells have.
They trick both the cutters and the fixers.
Yeah, now we're not assassinating anymore. Now we're actually engineering. We've gone from killing to refashioning.
Although haven't we been designing genes, doing a form of genetic engineering for, I don't know, like 30 years?
Yes, but not like this.
Genome editing technologies have been around for a long time, but none of them have been as powerful as CRISPR is.
That's Beth Shapiro from UC Santa Cruz. She was actually one of the biologists that I drunkenly talked to at that thing.
Was it a modern art museum? I can't even really remember.
I don't remember either.
Must have been quite an evening to have the setting be so vague.
Anyhow, here's how she put it to us. Back in the day, this was just like 2 years ago, you would have these gene editor things. You would take one, put it in a cell.
And what happened before was you would give it some instructions about where to go, and it might go there, but it might go to somewhere that's kind of related to where that was.
So it's like, you just take a right at Staten Island, but it takes a left.
And not only would it take a left at Staten Island and not find there, but it would have cost you a fortune and taken up 6 months of your time to get that thing. And now, you know, it's really easy.
You just give it that mugshot.
And it goes, I'm going to find that guy, exactly.
So it seems to be pretty precise, and it's cheap. Like, the old tools would set you back about $5,000 just to use them once. CRISPR, about $75. And here's the kicker, says Carl. It seems, at the moment, that you can take these things out of bacteria, stick them into almost any other creature, and it still works.
You can use the same CRISPR system on anything.
Can you, like, do it if corn is vulnerable to a certain pest? You can do it in corn?
Do it in corn. Do it in anything. I have not. I'm waiting for someone to say, CRISPR doesn't work in species X. And I have not heard of that.
So basically what you have for the first time in science is this gene editing technology that is cheap, precise, and possibly universal. And Jennifer Doudna says the moment the full impact of that landed on her,
I literally had, you know, the hairs on the back of my neck were standing up. Just processing the fact that this thing exists, you know, and that you could actually program it to cut DNA, and just like this molecular scissors, and I can just program it and it cuts DNA wherever I want.
It is amazing, unless you think about it further, which we will do in just a moment. I feel a cloud coming in over the horizon. It's over there.
Do you see?
I see. It's getting sort of dark over there, but we'll be right back.
Hey there. This is Bethany Barton in Los Angeles, California. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Radiolab is supported by Babbel. Sometimes self-improvement can feel like a pretty overwhelming journey. So what if this year you just got a tiny bit better every day? When you're learning a new language with Babbel, that's exactly what you're doing. Babbel is a science-backed language learning app with quick 10-minute lessons that have been handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. You can learn everything you need to have real-world conversations, café, s'il vous plaît, from vocabulary words to culture and more. And if Babbel can help you start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks, imagine what you could do in a few months or a full year. Here is a special limited-time deal for Radiolab listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/radiolab. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/radiolab, spelled BABBEL.com/radiolab. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This is Radiolab. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Okay, so clearly the possibilities are there to use CRISPR to treat disease, right? Mm-hmm. But what if you could get a little more fanciful, right? Like, what if you could actually go back in time and resurrect long-lost creatures? I mean, this is something that Beth Shapiro has talked about a lot.
We could reconstruct, using a computer, what the genome sequence of the ancestor of all birds was, and that would have been a kind of dinosaur, and then we could use CRISPRs to turn a chicken into that thing.
Or what if you could take an elephant and snip, 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 gradually turn it into its long-lost relative, the woolly mammoth?
No.
Because they're related, but if you, their genes are similar.
But the woolly mammoth is over.
Well, right, but if you know the woolly mammoth genome, which they do because they apparently got it off some bone or some hair,
yeah,
then you could compare the number of differences, use CRISPR to CRISPR out the different parts of the elephant and put in woolly mammoth instead.
So if you can, in effect, go backwards in time and make changes, then obviously I think you can go the other way too, right? I mean, mm-hmm, humans are good at design. We're designing animals. So if it doesn't seem to me to be a crazy notion to imagine parents all over the world wanting, I don't know, taller children, so silencing the short genes and favoring the taller genes, getting rid of weak muscles and going for stronger ones, and on and on and on. And I don't know where the designing stops.
We sort of got into all of this with Carl Zimmer, science writer.
If you can be very, very gene specific and you learn more and more about genes over time, why couldn't you invent a creature? Why couldn't you make a pig with wings? You might one day get sophisticated enough to do that.
There's no winged pig lab. You know, the best you're going to hope for right now is a woolly mammoth lab, and that's down the hall from where the real action is.
But now there's a hall, and at the end of the hall is a winged pig lab. It hasn't been built yet. It may be 20 years from now, but that's what you're looking at.
What's wrong with this thought?
Like, why shouldn't anyone realize that that's really what we're talking about here?
Well, because you can't make winged pigs just because of sort of evolutionary barriers, okay?
Well, there's no real reason for pigs to fly except for the joke.
Calm down.
I'm just joking.
I mean, okay, I don't think that we need a federal Department of Homeland Pig with Wing Security. I think we're okay there, all right? What we do need is, like, we do need to, like, figure out what are we going to do about CRISPR in humans. I mean, they're going to be using CRISPR for cancer, okay? You know, they're going to take people's immune cells out of their body, and they're going to use CRISPR to basically allow them to make proteins that are going to be able to grab onto cancer cells and attack their own cancer. Yeah,
well, you have to be for that. I mean, you have to be.
Well, I don't know. I mean, are you for
you are tinkering with someone's own body. You are altering their own cells, you know?
Dude, this...
Where do I... It's just, I tell you, this is me. I don't know if it's a religious thought or just the thought of a conservative person, but I mean, I grew up in the test tube baby era. I now know many wonderful adult formerly test tube babies, and I remember being astonished that I don't know where the sacred begins and ends anymore on that particular turf. I guess what I'm instead on is I'm on on a Hobbesian view of human beings, that there is something about human beings, mm-hmm. including scientist human beings, mm-hmm. all human beings, that is, there is a darkness and a light. There's an angelic side to being human, and there's a very, very difficult side. And as the human beings get more and more power to create and design and essentially create a future, that future will include the imaginations, both light and dark, of humans. And that will be new in the world.
I don't think it is new, because if you go back to the start of the scientific revolution, someone like Francis Bacon would say explicitly, like, science is going to be both about learning about how the world works and using that knowledge to control it. You know, this has been discovered. This has been published. Everybody knows it exists. Mm. If you're going to say, like, okay, now we're going to outlaw this.
I'm not suggesting that.
Well, what are you suggesting then?
I think we should cringe a little as opposed to just okay. have a big party.
All right, let's all cringe. Ready? One, two, three.
Don't make fun of it. That's not
now
fair.
Now what? We've cringed. And now what? What do we do now?
I don't know.
Well, we all cringed, if that's what you're arguing
no,
for.
No, you cringed meanly and you cringed with attitude. I'm no, cringing with
I would like
because
to
you're afraid of like dragons. you're saying, oh my god.
Yes, I'm afraid of dragons now.
Okay, so that conversation with Carl was 4 months ago, and a lot has happened in that time. Because to the question that you asked, like, where does the sacred begin and end? Well, one of the lines that had been drawn by Jennifer Doudna and others was that we should not use this technology on humans who haven't been born yet, meaning not on sperm cells or egg cells, because if you CRISPR, say, an embryo,
that is a permanent change, right? That is a change to the DNA that will be passed on to their children
and their children's children and their children's children's children.
And you can't ask the person if that's okay, because you're doing it before they're born.
Consent becomes a real issue. And if you imagine making these changes and they cascade through generation after generation,
you could affect the evolution of organisms. And it's, I don't want to say trivial, but it's, you know, it's fairly easy to do it.
Wow.
It's kind of profound. I feel it's really profound.
Profound, but it was just an idea. That is, until...
For the first time in history, researchers in China have successfully edited the human genome in an embryo.
Just 2 months ago, it was announced that a Chinese team
from Sun Yat-sen University used a technique called CRISPR
to edit DNA in human embryos.
It's a way of hacking evolution itself.
Well, this is hugely controversial.
Now, these embryos the Chinese team had edited, they were created through IVF, and they were not viable.
These are embryos that are not going to actually develop into a person, so they're going to be discarded anyway.
But still, if they could figure it out with those embryos, what's to stop any of us from going further?
Biologists and bioethicists are sounding an alarm.
The scientists face accusations that they crossed an ethical line.
That this sort of thing could be sort of a slippery slope toward
designer babies.
Essentially genetically engineering the human race.
I'm going to use it sure. as a chance to kind of test your levels.
Okay.
Now that the cringe party had spread and Robert didn't seem like such a loon, we called up Carl again.
Well, we have to revisit because in our Armageddon conversation, in which I believe I was extremely alarmist and you were extremely downputting,
mm-hmm.
I feel that I should do a small little parade called the... that, remember the Alamo. It's like, remember China. And you have to... So you should just begin anytime you want, like getting on your knees and saying how sorry you are, and we can start from there.
I'm sorry. So are we actually surrounded by an army of clones with superpowers?
Not yet. Not yet. But I think the dike has been opened. I believe I'm going to quote somebody who said maybe a few weeks ago, I think he wrote, maybe it was last week even, writing for National Geographic. I think it was. Maybe it was somebody named Carl who said that the news from China, and that news was probably... the beginning of an entire new era.
I think I actually said it was a historical moment.
That's right, yes. That's
yes, right. and I still stand by that.
Do you feel differently now than the first time we talked?
Yeah, that's really the question.
I don't feel different, actually, because there's really no scientific surprise here.
He says people have been doing all these CRISPR experiments on all these different mammals.
We're mammals.
This is bound to happen. And in fact, it may be happening more than we think. One account in the journal Nature said that 4 other Chinese labs are doing this kind of work as we speak. But Carl also told us which he said was unsurprising too, but I actually find it kind of surprising, that the CRISPR work this Chinese team did didn't work very well.
It worked kind of. I mean, in only a few of the cases did they really get exactly what they wanted.
They tried using CRISPR in about 86 embryos, and they only got it to work right in maybe 28. And in a lot of them, CRISPR's made the wrong cuts and screwed up the cells.
And that led them to conclude that this is a technology that's not ready right now for application in the human germline. And I agree.
Huh.
We still are in this kind of fortunate position where we can say, oh, well, it's dangerous, so we shouldn't use it on human embryos. I just don't think that we're going to be able to sort of find refuge there in like 10 or 20 years. In 10 or 20 years, you know, CRISPR will be so sophisticated that people will be able to say, I can get you the change you want, and I can do it safely. I can guarantee you that you will have human embryos that have the alteration in the particular gene you want. So then what?
In fact, Jennifer Doudna told us that this experiment or similar experiments have been repeated in mice with more advanced CRISPR systems, because apparently there are many different kinds, and there it was done with almost no errors.
Sometimes I feel like we're sort of displacing all our ethical concerns onto something that hasn't happened yet. If we really are concerned about what we're doing to the human gene pool, you know, it's already here.
Take, as an example, in vitro fertilization. About 60,000 kids are born a year through IVF, and it's probable that some of those parents chose whether they wanted a boy or a girl.
And when people started doing IVF, there was a huge controversy. People said this was dangerous, this was unnatural. I don't see people who are unable to sleep at night because of the existence of IVF.
Yeah.
You know, now I'm going to sound like I'm on Robert's side of this. I mean, okay, so
it won't hurt. You know, it will.
Okay,
not.
All right. Here we go. So, okay, so
deep breath.
So you guys know about all the stuff going on in Iceland where they're looking at people's DNA and, you know, they're looking for disease genes and so on. And when they were looking at these Icelandic people, they found that some people had a gene that protects them against Alzheimer's. It reduces their odds of getting Alzheimer's. Let's imagine your doctor said, now, if you'd like, for an extra $1,000, we will take these IVF embryos and we will use CRISPR to give them the Alzheimer protecting variant. Would you like that? Do you want to add that to your procedure?
Sure, yeah.
Or would you like your child to face a future of Alzheimer's? Your choice.
See, here's my thing. Here's my thing with this whole thing. Yeah. I'm a little bit haunted by the thing you said, which is that when it's not dangerous anymore, what will we do? And I'm afraid we've already answered that question. That it's not a question that's open anymore. Because if we're already doing this kind of stuff, and who's going to say no to that? Who's going to say
exactly.
no to that?
That's what he just was demonstrating. Yeah.
Yeah.
We've already answered the question.
Yeah. We may have.
Many thanks to science writer Carl Zimmer, who's written many books. You can check him out at carlzimmer.com or at radiolab.org. This piece was produced by Molly Webster. We had original music this hour by Eric Kowalski, otherwise known as Casino vs. Japan.
Special thanks to Anna Rusquet-Paz,
Lee McGuire,
Dr. Blake Wiedenhaft,
Dr. Luciano Marafini,
Dr. Sean Burgess,
and Dr. Junwei Shi. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Thanks for listening.
To hear the message again, press 2. To delete it, start of message.
Hello, this is Carl Zimmer.
Hi, this is Beth Shapiro.
Hello, this is Jennifer Doudna.
Radio Lab is produced by Jad Abumrad.
Our staff includes Brenna Farrell, Ellen Horn, Dylan Keefe,
Matt Kilty, Lynn Levy,
Andy Mills,
Latif Nasser, Melissa O'Donnell, Kelsey Padgett,
Ariane Wack, Molly Webster,
Sean Wheeler, and Jamie York. I think I said Webster. Let me try it again.
With help from Danny Lewis, Kelly Prime, and Damiano Marchetti.
Our fact checkers are Eva Dasher and Michelle Harris.
Awesome. Thank you much.
See you later.
End of message.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.